It's Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, President Trump's budget proposal is out, and as expected, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts took a huge hit. What will that mean for stations like, well, KBIA? Libel cases can be hard to prove. That's why a $1.1 million judgment against two newspaper owners in California is catching publishers' eyes. We'll talk about that case. And we'll take a moment to remember legendary reporter and columnist Jimmy Breslin. He died this weekend at the age of 88. But let's start with this quote. I'm not a big media press access person. I personally don't need it. Not necessarily the words you want to be hearing from your Secretary of State, especially when it's following a trip to the DMZ in Korea. Why is Rex Tillerson so reluctant to give the media access?
Well, I mean, he claims that he would like to be able to settle diplomatic issues before announcing them. He says, I don't really need to talk to reporters. I've been very good, you know, negotiating all kinds of things as a business person internationally for years. It'll save me money and time on my plane, yada, yada, yada. I don't know. I mean, what he really wants, but he's clearly decided early on to kind of mimic what's going on with the press and the rest of the Trump administration.
You talk about the efficiencies that come with it. Is that maybe one of the growing pains that's a result of somebody coming from corporate America, a CEO, now in doing the people's work?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's that sort of low-key approach. We don't want to be on the front page. We basically want to do our work and not seek the limelight. I mean, you know, Tillerson was known, but he wasn't known in the kinds of circles that he's in now. And having that kind of scrutiny day in and day out is uncomfortable for him. I mean, you can see it when you watch him on when they do have some access. Mm-hmm. He says very little. He doesn't go over to the cameras, and then he moves pretty quickly to get off screen. So, I mean, you're watching this after John Kerry, who had been in the limelight as a senator and a secretary of state, and Hillary Clinton, who was first lady, senator, secretary of state. They understood that you could use the media, especially in diplomacy, to push forward the agenda of the administration.
The problem is, no matter what his motivation, stories can occur where you need to have, at the very least, a pool reporter, a pool photographer on hand. For example, when he was in South Korea, he was supposed to meet with the interim president and other diplomats, and there was a report in a Korean newspaper that he didn't meet with them because he was, quote, fatigued, whatever that means. There were no American media, well, there was one reporter, a reporter chosen to go along, but she was not chosen as a pool reporter, and so she didn't immediately ask questions about that. And so who are we supposed to believe? Are we supposed to believe a Korean news source or our own journalist in telling us whether the Secretary of State might have a health issue?
I mean, this is going to be a problem, not only for Tillerson, but for others within this administration who use this same sort of ploy. Things are going to happen. It's not a question of if, but when. And if you're not there to give the information on behalf of not just the Trump administration, but the people of the United States of America, especially in the case of Secretary of State, bad things can happen. And that's the problem here, is that this, I don't want to be dealing with the press. That's one of the things that's really going to cause a problem.
And I hope the public's not confused by all of this. The journalists who go along mm-hmm. on these trips with the Secretary of State, they or their news organizations pay for that. They're not getting a free ride on the behest of the federal government. News organizations
pay. Pay a lot.
I mean, in a lot of this, it seems like every story is painted with this political brush of the Trump administration against the media. And this is one of the, in this area, mm-hmm. I think, is where there needs to be a definite line drawn to say, wait a minute, this is the press covering the business of the United States.
This is the battle worth fighting.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Well, KBIA's spring membership drive ended about a week ago, and we came in slightly under goal, meaning that the budget is going to be tight. So it really didn't help Thursday when the Trump administration released its budget proposal, and including cutting funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, including the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And that means that as it trickles down, public television and radio stations like us are going to feel the pain. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of what this could ultimately mean for public media, I want to take a listen to this. It's a video that's going viral thanks to the producers at What's Trending. Here's Sesame Street's Elmo getting the news.
Elmo, you're being laid off.
Just like that? Elmo's been working at Sesame Street for 32 years! Elmo,
the Trump administration is getting all arts and education funding from the new congressional budget.
But Elmo's rent just went up!
Elmo, you're gonna land on your feet, don't worry.
But Elmo hasn't been unemployed since the 80s! What's going to happen to Elmo's insurance? Elmo has pre-existing condition!
Well, you should apply for government health care. Well, you can. That's being gutted too.
Where is Elmo supposed to go? Elmo's only real talent is being Elmo!
I've been an Elmo fan from way back, and watching Elmo get laid off, even in this parody, it had some laughable moments, but at the same time, when you watch the whole thing, which goes about 3 minutes, it's really painful to watch because Elmo represents real people.
True. I'm not sure that that's the making the best case for keeping funding for CPB or for the Arts and Humanities Endowments. Because, frankly, Sesame Street has been making a lot of its money by being first on HBO for more than a year.
And true, yet people recognize. That becomes the image.
But I think I would argue for other things instead of for Sesame Street if I were arguing to retain that funding. And we should be clear, this is the president's wish list. Every president puts out a budget, but Congress decides. And Congress, despite what past presidents have wanted to do, has always kept funding for public broadcasting and for the arts and humanities. It's a little different situation now, having the Republicans in charge of all houses, but I think it's a little bit early to say that they're going to cut the funding.
That is a fair point. When Elmo says he hasn't been unemployed in 30 years, that's because when these cuts have been put on the table in the past, Congress hasn't let them go through.
Yeah, I think what generally happens is that the congressmen all of a sudden realize that, wait a minute, my pet project is a part of that, or part of my constituency is going to be hurt by this, and then they sort of pull it back. But I do think that there is a threat here to the radio stations in a lot of the areas where Trump won, because they're rural areas, they're small radio stations, and they get a lot of their local news from these community radio stations, and that's a problem. But the other thing that I think is really shocking is that we're talking about the Corporation for Public Broadcast, the National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities. Now they're talking about cutting NIH, which is the National Institutes of Health. So now, all of a sudden, you're talking about a lot of R&D, research and development, in areas that deal with life and death that are being cut. They're also talking about cutting the program that deals with infectious diseases worldwide and the rapid response force for that. They're talking about cutting that budget.
If you think about the last couple of years, that's where you have Zika, that's where you have
Ebola. Yes, exactly. So to me, that's even more of a problem with this budget that I don't think people are really paying attention to.
I do say, well, when we come back to the issues of the arts and humanities endowments and for the public broadcasting, one of the problems that each of those agencies has is it's been perceived, and I think legitimately, this isn't just a talking point, a lot of Republicans and a lot of conservatives feel that all of those agencies have been elitist, left-leaning, urban-oriented, and not so much some of the constituencies they represent. Now, some of those, I think that NPR, for example, just to take a look at our own network, has done a lot over the years to try to peel away that image of being too liberal, too elitist, too left coast or whatever, and has done a lot of coverage that does reach other people. But there is some concern there, and that's why I think Congress is inclined to the arguments to get rid of this funding.
I totally agree with you on that point. I think that NPR, you're right, NPR has done a good job. I think other areas involving arts and entertainment, and including the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, could do more in getting out there and showing that they have a wider perspective than just the urban areas and the West and the East Coast.
One of the things that you find with both the National Endowment for the Arts and for the Humanities is that their money is kind of like seed money. So it's not just the money from the federal government that will make it difficult to get these projects, these cultural and arts projects in communities funded. That's seed money that leverages other foundations and private donors. And so that's why there's a lot of concern there.
But
it's not just the dollars
from
Washington.
Yeah, but you know, the reality of the situation is I don't think people are really going to understand what these programs mean until they lose them.
Mm-hmm.
And now there is a real threat to the loss of a lot of this. And then people are going to realize that you know, either you really cared about it and you're going to support it, or you didn't. And so I think that's the point right now that we're at, not just with this, but with a lot of other things.
You asked Amy at the beginning about what would be the impact on stations like KBIA.
Sure.
And my guess is that for KBIA, which has a diversified funding source, has a really strong donor base, has good underwriting and can get a lot more, probably the day-to-day operations after a period of time would be okay. We could continue to work. The problem is that CPB funds a lot of innovation initiatives. So Harvest Public Media would not exist on KBIA if it hadn't been for an initial grant from them. Our health reporting and other specialty desks that we have, those people get funded at least initially by that kind of seed money.
And I think the strength of those kind of initiatives is what's really made a connection to a lot of those areas that were voted for Trump and were able to get that news and information. They're going to lose out on that.
Okay, well, this weekend we lost one of journalism's legends, Jimmy Breslin. For decades, he covered New York's five boroughs like no one else, and his work was loved and respected well west of the Hudson River. NPR's David Folkenflik offered this remembrance on Reliable Sources Sunday on CNN.
He was a colorful, classic New York columnist who really was of the city. He put his heart into it. He was contentious, he was combative, colorful. Occasionally he was so provocative he could be offensive, but he had a heart. And part of it, I think there were these twin threads I was thinking about over the past hour. He stuck up for the little guy, the working class guy, and he also believed firmly in the idea of social progress and that people should have a fair chance in this society. And you could see that in his columns.
You know, people have been talking a lot, too, about the column that he wrote right after the Kennedy assassination, the one where everybody else is talking about the funeral, about the continuity of government. He wanted to tell the story of the people and went and found the man who dug Kennedy's grave, told his story, his reactions.
Yeah, and Breslin had the ability to connect with the common man,
mm-hmm.
the common woman,
mm-hmm.
And he would go out in search of those stories, and he would find them, and he would tell them in ways that really connected to people. And as a journalist, during his time period, that was very important. And a lot of journalists tried to emulate him, but many of them basically couldn't do it. And the reason for that, I think, is because he took the time to actually find those people. And he didn't let deadlines get in the way. He didn't let... in some ways, he didn't let his personality get in the way, even though his personality sort of was an outgrowth of that. But he used it to tell those stories. And I think that was one of the things that sort of endeared him to a lot of people.
Breslin was, you know, what I think was the greatest thing about him is that he focused on his community. Now, his community was New York City, but he focused on real people. And I don't know that there are a lot of columnists out there who still do that. On the other hand, we should say, and although he's passed, you don't want to say bad things about people who've just passed away, he wasn't a saint.
No,
he ran into trouble at Newsday back in 1990 when he basically stormed into the newsroom and yelled some sexist and racist epithets about a colleague because he didn't like a column she'd written. And when he apologized, you know, and everybody thought, well, he really meant that he had apologized, he shows up on a radio talk show and says some things that made it sound like maybe that wasn't such an apology. And there were a lot of white male columnists and journalists who were defending him at the time. Oh, this is too much political correctness. So some lessons we're dealing with today, they were dealing with, you know, 27 years ago.
So let me ask you this. You know, Ernest, you were saying, too, that there's kind of sort of this generation of journalists who've tried to emulate the style and have wanted to grow up to be Jimmy Breslin, at least as the person that they grew up reading. Are the days of the Jimmy Breslins, of the Mike Roycos, are they over?
I don't think they're necessarily over. I mean, you have to remember that, you know, back during his time, you had a lot of readers of newspaper. I'm talking, when I say newspaper, I'm not talking about the online version.
You're talking about dead trees in someone's hands.
Yes, dead trees in someone's hands.
With newsprint on their fingertips.
Every day. Yeah. And they looked forward to that. I think where that could possibly be now is podcasts, and where people are connecting with someone who's doing that type of journalism on a daily or weekly basis. In that regard, that may be where that is, but that's going to be hard to find because there's so much of it out there.
I don't think the community columnist is dead, but there's certainly been a big decline. I mean, you can still find people like Mitch Albom in Detroit or Dave Barry or Leonard Pitts in Miami, people who have a national audience but who are focusing on their local community. And frankly, if you want to talk about somebody at the local level that still is caring about the community, holding the powerful accountable, telling stories about little people, we could focus on our own George Kennedy at the Columbia, Missouri. And he's still doing it, even though he's retired. And that's the kind of commitment that a lot more publications ought to have.
But that takes getting into your community and understanding what's really going on at the street level. And we've talked about this before. A lot of journalists don't take the time to do that.
Or aren't in a market long enough to do that either.
Exactly.
So, Ernest, you brought up podcasts. Last week, we talked about that hot new podcast, Missing Richard Simmons. Well, the latest episode dropped Monday night. I got a chance to listen to it yesterday. To you?
I took an opportunity to listen to it. It didn't hold, after about 10 minutes, it just didn't hold my attention. I'm just going to be honest about it. I was like, if you can't tell me anything new that I don't already know, then why am I listening to this?
Mike, your note to me was was just short of calling it lame.
Well, I listened to all six episodes.
Okay.
And the first three, when he's laying out into the background of Richard Simmons and his bizarre disappearance and all the conspiracy theories around what might have happened to him.
It's kind of fascinating.
Including his maid maybe holding him hostage in his house.
Yeah.
That was all interesting. But what it turned out in the end was that he just decided for whatever reason to walk away, that he's fine. The police have checked on him. His, you know, his brother has checked on him. His publicist has checked on him. And he's okay. And so what it basically was this sort of long story about whether or not celebrities, especially celebrities who decide to reach out to real people beyond the scope of their public performances, whether they owe something to those people when it's time for them to walk away.
And to me, in the end, when I'm listening to this, it's like, it just seemed to me this guy was sad, disappointed, and somewhat mad that Richard Simmons won't reach out to him and say, hey, I'm okay.
Right. and I almost felt like I'd been listening to gossip for the last 2 hours of it. And kind of felt like we should all just leave Richard Simmons alone.
Leave the guy alone.
There's a fascinating read from NPR that we have on our links blog that really gave me reason for pause last night when I was looking at it, because it mentions and brings up one of my favorite childhood authors, Judy Blume, and how she would be approached by readers who would send her letters, and because they had gotten to know or think they got to know her through her books, that they would contact her and bring her their problems or looking for advice or coming of age issues. And she mentions in this interview that it reached a point where she had to not only step away, but actually seek therapy herself from the secondary trauma, which kind of made me look at Richard Simmons and kind of want to give him a hug and say, I'm sorry we've done this.
No, I mean, I think that same piece, the writer, Linda Holmes, summed it up pretty well, too. She said, friendship isn't therapy and therapy isn't friendship.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who confused that.
Right.
You know, Richard Simmons just maybe didn't invest as much in those relationships as the people who were very needy and wanted Richard Simmons' help.
Right.
Okay, well, what's a pundit? Whose job is it to be a lightning rod to do when they find themselves sharing a personal opinion that may not toe the company line? The Blaze's conservative commentator, Tommy Lahren, appeared on The View and shared these not-so-conservative feelings.
You call yourself a conservative a conservative Republican and a constitutional conservative, but you also consider yourself pro-choice, which is interesting to me because 68% of conservative Republicans think that abortion should be illegal across the board.
No, I'm pro-choice, and here's why. I am a constitutional, you know, someone that loves the Constitution. I am someone that's for limited government, and so I can't sit here and be a hypocrite and say I'm for limited government, but I think that the government should decide what women do with their bodies. I can sit here and say that as a Republican, and I can say, you know what, I'm for limited government, so stay out of my guns. And you can stay out of my body as well. So I think it's...
You need to go out and speak to women about that.
I do. I do every day. I do every day. And, you know, I get a lot of attacks from conservative women as well. Yeah. You know, I think it's equal hate from all sides for
me. Well, you don't have any...
She's caught a lot of flack for those comments, chief among them from Blaze founder Glenn Beck. And she's been benched and suspended until next week. What she did, though, was stir the pot. Isn't that her job?
Yeah, I don't think we should feel sorry for her. I mean, she certainly has said a lot of contradictory things. I mean, she said that about being pro-choice on The View. About 3 months before that, she made comments about abortion being murder. So I'm not sure that she might not want to have it both ways, but she's going to be fine. She's a bona fide media celebrity. She's young. She's pretty. She's outrageous. She's all the things that people want in a media
celebrity. Contract is up.
Her contract is up.
You know, so she's probably looking for the next gig. So I think this is a ploy on her part.
Okay. Well, libel. It can be pretty hard to prove, but apparently it's happened in California. Mike, you brought this topic to my attention, wanted to talk about this. Tell me a little bit more about this case.
So basically, there's this small news outlet in California called Cal Coast News, and two reporters were sued for libel by a guy who said he claimed he was libeled because these two reporters said that, one, he'd lost a job in the past, had been fired, which wasn't true. They said that he'd encouraged other people to cheat, which they didn't prove. They said that, you know, all kinds of bad things about him, like he'd received a sweetheart contract when he really hadn't. And the problem was the journalists relied on what they said were a bunch of anonymous sources, but when they were called into court, they couldn't produce any of those sources. They
a couple of them had died.
The reporter said she lost her notes when the computer ate them, you know, right. Or her dog ate them or something. Yeah. And then when confronted with the fact that these statements were not true, or at least not verifiable, did they pull down the story? No, they did not. So the actual malice standard is there. A jury found for the defendant or for the plaintiff and said you should pay him $1 million.
I mean, and one of the things that I found fascinating was that the witness for the plaintiffs was a friend of mine, and basically, you know, she's a seasoned journalist. She teaches at San Francisco State, and she said, "Look, there's nothing here to substantiate what you're talking about." So, I mean, to me, it's one of those things where you can have unidentified sources, but when you have to prove the story, you need to be able to show something there, and clearly they didn't do that, at least not to the jury's mind.
Even if you want to give them the benefit of the doubt, they're a small staff trying to do investigative reporting in a community. Some people say they've done some good work in the past, but it just takes a slip-up like this to ruin your entire reputation.
And we talk about it all the time. It only takes once. Yeah. It only takes happening once for you to lose the credibility, and that's what happened here.
Okay, well, this is something that we used to hear about a lot in schools. Internet filters designed to keep students from looking up sensitive material online, blocking the students from doing research on topics like breast cancer. Well, now there's some pretty strong criticism that YouTube's sensitive content filter is filtering out too much and is hiding LGBTQ content when the restricted mode is turned on. The Google-owned platform issued a statement saying that it regrets any confusion that LGBTQ+ videos are available in restricted mode, but videos that discuss more sensitive subjects may not be. It goes on to say the intention of restricted mode is to filter out mature content for the tiny subset of users who want a more limited experience. What type of content exactly are they filtering out here?
I'm not sure right now what kind of content they're because, you know, people go to that, especially schools. Mm-hmm. They go to that to try to make sure that when students are using the computers at school, that they're only using it as prescripted by the school board. And that changes from place to place.
Okay.
And they use YouTube in doing that research. And just the mention of LGBTQ in one area of the country or the state sends triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is one of the things that causes problems in trying to determine whether or not this filter is actually working.
I'd say that YouTube, I mean, they did issue an apology, but they also are trying to fix the problem. And
it's a hard problem to fix.
I know, I understand that. And that's why I think it's kind of interesting that a lot of people are attacking them on social media when YouTube is probably the platform for more LGBTQ-friendly videos than any other place in the world. But some of the content providers found out that this filter, which has been in place for like 6 years or whatever, right, found out that it was blocking some of their content. They raised the issue, and so now you get the typical reaction on social media. Everybody gets out of control rather than looking to see whether or not it's a problem.
But I think this goes back to the stories that we were talking about early in the fall about Facebook back during the election. I mean, I think it goes back to that. Who's making the decision to filter? And how is that being dictated by the company that owns it?
And how much of it could be algorithmic? I may tag this video today when we put our program up on YouTube with an LGBTQ tag because thinking somebody might be interested, and that might trigger the filter for all we know. There's another issue to bring up about content being taken down from YouTube. This one has to do with more than 20,000 video lectures posted by the University of California, Berkeley. They've been published by the university and taken down by the university following an ADA compliance complaint, but they're on their way back. It's not the university that's putting them back up, though.
No, there's a startup company that says it's going to load up all the videos and put them online so people can access them. But I don't think I'd be too quick to make Cal Berkeley the bad guy here either. They have been making thousands and thousands of hours of lectures from eminent scholars available free to anybody who wants to watch them. They're told that if they don't transcribe them for people who have, you know, visual disabilities,
providing closed captions,
then they would be sued under the ADA. And so they said, well, we can't go there. We don't have the money to transcribe all these videos. I think this is a short-term problem, though, because frankly, artificial intelligence is making it possible now to do language translation, and I think it'll be in the very near future, this will all be done automatically, and we won't have to worry about it anymore.
Well, I mean, when I was reading this, I was wondering who actually has ownership of this. I mean, is it owned by Berkeley? Is it owned by the individuals who actually
the put professors the professors themselves
who did the lectures themselves? And now that this startup company is doing it, I mean, they're saying they're going to put it out there for free, but that doesn't mean that they can't change their mind somewhere down the road. I mean, that to me would be a concern as a professor who
has their own intellectual property.
Exactly, the whole intellectual property.
As we're told that our lectures are our intellectual property.
But I haven't seen in any of the stories so far how is this startup is going to get around the problem of transcribing them. Because if they're putting them out there in the public for free, they have to be transcribed in order to meet ADA.
I think part of it, and I could be totally wrong here, is that it's a private company that's doing it as opposed to Berkeley, which has and gets government money as a university, and that's where and how some of those rules are different. Well, we are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about all the topics we talked about today on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to our Jazz Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Kyle Felling for handling the audio. Our original theme music is composed by Tim Pilcher. Lauren Wortman is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.